meter band.
It is Monday, October the 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, Kurdish leader Barzani abruptly resigns.
He's been indicating that he would leave by early 2018, but he clearly hoped to see this independence drive as the crowning achievement of his 50-year history as a leader of the Kurds.
Also ahead, Catalonian independence on hold for now, health care in Africa, plus the music of Gordon Lightfoot. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. After 5 decades in power, the president of Iraq's self-ruled northern Kurdish region, Masoud Barzani, has dissolved his powers as president, distributing them among the Kurdish prime minister, as well as parliament and the judiciary. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Jeffrey says he was not surprised by Barzani's actions.
He had no other choice. He basically has, because if he steps down, then that will open the door to the step of annulling the referendum vote, because that is the demand of both the Abadi government in Baghdad and all of the neighbors. And this is actually a very important step, because the U.S., France, and I suspect other countries in essentially the Western sphere have been urging Abadi to be more careful in the last several days. We have a ceasefire that Abadi announced. The Kurdish Peshmerga and the Iraqi military forces are now discussing where the lines of contact and liaisons will be rather than shooting at each other. So I think that for the moment, this crisis is reaching an end, and this is a very good thing.
What led to Mr. Barzani's decision, which is rather surprising to me?
First of all, he had been hinting for over a year that he wanted to end his presidency, which has been irregular since 2013. He had an extension through 2013 or 2014, and then he decided to unconstitutionally continue in office because of problems with a parliamentary quorum and that kind of thing. So he's been indicating that he would leave by early 2018, but he clearly hoped to see this independence drive as the crowning achievement of his 50-year history as a leader of the Kurds. In contrast, it's become his biggest blunder.
As you indicated, he's had a long political career in the KRG. So what happens to him now? Does he just fade off the scene?
Well, I've seen few Middle Eastern leaders really fade, so we have to see. And, of course, he has several close relatives in the Barzani family who are in key positions, the head of intelligence, the prime minister is his nephew, and we'll see what they'll do. His powers are being divided up between the courts, the prime ministry, which is his nephew, and the parliament, which is still semi-defunct. But what's going to happen next, we don't know.
Will there be a possibility of reconciliation between the Kurds and the central government in Baghdad?
There's already the beginning of a reconciliation. How much and under which conditions will be dependent upon, A, the positions first and foremost of both Erbil, the Kurds, whoever's in charge in Baghdad, and B, how much outside powers, most importantly the U.S. and Turkey, but also the Europeans and the Arabs led by the Saudis, pressure Baghdad not to try to humiliate or to break up the Kurds, and balanced by Iran trying to get Baghdad to do just that. So this is going to be yet another conflict between the West, broadly defined, and the Iranians over this issue in Iraq, just like so many other issues in the Levant right now.
Sunday, in his comments, Mr. Barzani said the Iraqi attack on Kirkuk and other Kurdish-held territory vindicated his view that Baghdad no longer believes in federalism and wants to curtail Kurdish rights.
No, the point is that the KRG exceeded its constitutional rights by seizing a great deal of territory, bits and pieces of it before 2014, more or less tolerated by Baghdad and by the U.S. authorities at the time, beyond the three provinces that were recognized in the constitution. But then after 2014, they seized huge swaths, including Kirkuk and its very valuable oil fields. And there was never any legal basis for them to hold on to them. And yet in doing the referendum, not just in the three provinces, but also in those disputed areas, including Kirkuk, Barzani was basically asserting that not only would he break away from Iraq, but that he would take huge areas that had not entirely Kurdish populations. And that was what was the trigger for a sharp military reaction after a very sharp diplomatic reaction throughout the region. That's what gave the Iraqi forces the confidence and the authority to go on the offensive.
Mr. Barzani took aim at the U.S. for failing to back the Kurds. We tried to stop bloodshed, but the Iraqi forces and Popular Mobilization Front, the Shia militia, kept advancing using U.S. weapons. Our people should now question whether the U.S. was aware of Iraq's attack and why they did not prevent it.
We have essentially guaranteed, ever since 1991, the Kurdish territories. The fighting was not in the Kurdish territories. It was in territories that Barzani had seized without asking permission of us. And he then conducted the referendum without checking with us in advance. We thought both of those were terrible mistakes. We're not on the line to defend every idiot action by our allies around the world.
Is Turkey and is Iran breathing a collective sigh of relief? And is the concept of an independent Kurdistan dead?
The concept of an independent Kurdistan is dead.
That is Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hundreds of thousands of Catalans took to the streets of Barcelona on Sunday to voice their opposition to the region's declaration of independence amid a vast political uncertainty for that region, which is in northeastern Spain. Catalonia's political leadership was fired on Saturday by central authorities in Madrid, who are trying to tame the worst political crisis Spain has seen for decades. So far, Catalan's former leader has insinuated that he will not be stepping down. Central government officials have called for an election in Catalonia on December 21st to choose new regional leadership. We asked Monash University Catalan scholar Stuart King if Catalonia is broadly divided about independence from Spain.
It is. The region has been divided, and this is the in some ways, the problem that not having the referendum or not recognizing the referendum has caused, because now we see those people who did not vote in the referendum take to the streets in support of being within Spain. And I think a referendum would have allowed those people to make a cleared, make the Catalans, it would have allowed the Catalans to have a clear decision about the future of Catalonia in relation to Spain.
We also asked Dr. King if this December election will give another opportunity to show the divisions in Catalonia.
No, I don't think so. I think it's people voted elections for lots of different issues, and I think I was surprised that the election was coming so soon afterwards. I can understand why the central government would do so, because they want to they don't want to have an extended rule in Catalonia, because it will seem like they are taking over. But I don't see that an election in 2 months' time will change anything substantially. We will still get substantial numbers of people voting in favour of pro-independence parties, and we will get substantial numbers of people voting against, well, in favour of pro-union parties. But people vote for, you know, traditionally for parties for lots of different reasons, not just for the question of independence.
He also noted it's likely the election might produce new leadership for Catalonia, which would be just as pro-independence as the government of President Carles Puigdemont, who was ousted over the weekend. We asked Dr. King if Spain made a tactical mistake in calling for an election so soon after taking over control of the Catalan government.
They are very careful that they don't want to be seen to take over Catalan institutions. There's a long history of this going back to 1714, initially when the general, the Catalan political and legal institutions were taken over by Madrid. Again, this happened in 1939 at the end of the Spanish Civil War when the Franco regime came to power. So they don't want to be seen to be repeating what in Catalonia is seen as an invasion, or a coup d'état to a certain extent. So they're playing a very fine line, but I don't think that an election within 2 months is going to resolve anything. We could be back in 2 months' time with again a divided parliament, with which could have or may not have a majority of pro-independence parties.
Stuart King is a Catalan scholar and professor at Monash University.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Rwanda's former Minister of Health, Dr. Agnes Binagwaho, says she is committed to fighting the burden of disease in Africa by making radical changes in healthcare and in health education. Rwanda achieved several Millennium Development Goals while under her leadership at the Health Department, including dramatically reducing maternal and early childhood mortality. Dr. Binagwaho recently visited Washington, D.C. for the premiere of a film that features her work. It is produced by Hollywood celebrities Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Binagwaho also was inducted into the National Academy of Medicine here in Washington. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about her mission as leader of the University of Global Health Equity, that is a new initiative started by the Boston-based charity Partners in Health.
So what is unique in the University of Global Health Equity is that equity is in the heart of everything we teach to our students, meaning we educate them to be able to serve the people across the world where they live. And the majority of the people in the world are still poor, and the majority of the people in the world still live in rural areas. That's the reason why we have building the university in the rural north. We bring the best teachers. We give high-quality education, but by being educated there in the rural north, our students, when they will be professionals, can be nurses, doctors, hospital managers, they will be able to work in a rural area. Normally, the students are educated in cities. Even when they are coming from a rural area, they are disconnected from their origin. They have difficulties to go back again and believe they can have a good life with a decent salary in rural Secondly, we give an integrated education. We no longer want that the student see the human body as a puzzle, the eyes, the lungs, the heart. It's a comprehensive, not only comprehensive physically, but also to respond to the true definition of health, a state of wellness physically, mentally, and societal.
What can developed countries learn from Rwanda's health achievements?
We also educate our students in cultural humility in many of the countries. If you look at the US and Europe, people no longer trust the health system as they should. And here in Rwanda, we have success to do that. Some other countries have made progress to do that by bringing the care where the people are living, meaning community health. It's so important. It decreases the number of hospitalizations. It improves the compliance to treatment. It makes the healthcare less costly, and it allows to make savings for families, communities, health insurance, and government. And with the same amount of money, we can provide more health services to a bigger number.
You were recently here in Washington, D.C. for a very special occasion. That was the premiere of the movie Bending the Arc. Can you tell us about this movie and what your role was in it?
The movie is the story of global health advocacy. And the big part of the story is the story of three young persons who didn't know how to provide care, totally understood that they have to provide care to the poor in Haiti and in Peru, and that each and everyone needed the quality care without a double standard. And they changed the rules in WHO, and they showed the world that it is possible to give quality care to the vulnerable. And it's not only a moral obligation, but it's also a business case, because virus, bacteria doesn't have borders, and we better treat people and contain outbreak and do that with respect and with the notion that health is a human right, the world will be a better place. And my role in that was just to show the preparedness of the country vis-a-vis the Ebola outbreak.
And also, you were inducted into the National Academy of Medicine, so congratulations to you for that.
Thank you. I really appreciate this honor. It's a great occasion to discuss of the health issues across the world with really eminent scientists, to give a contribution how to improve healthcare, making it more accessible to all in the budget. There is enough money in the world to do that. It's just a matter of goodwill and a matter of organization, which type of health sector you organize according to the population you want to serve. We don't have to give the same in each country, but the outcome should be the same because the rights are the same.
That was Dr. Agnes Binigwao. She was Rwanda's former Minister of Health, speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A small object thought to be an asteroid or maybe a comet was discovered recently by an astronomer at the University of Hawaii's Pan-STARRS 1 telescope. While discovery of such an object might be considered somewhat ordinary, where it is thought to have originated makes it remarkable. Scientists studying the object's speed and trajectory says it appears to have come from somewhere in the galaxy but outside of our solar system. If true, they say this would be the first interstellar object to be observed in the solar system and confirmed by astronomers. The object was discovered on October 19th after passing close to the sun on September 9th. It's thought to be less than 400 meters in diameter and is currently traveling at a speed of 44 kilometers per second. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for our music department report, and today it's the sounds of a Canadian superstar.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well.
in a castle dark or a fortress strong with chains upon my feet. You know that ghost is me, and I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see.
Billboard magazine once wrote that there are few careers in popular music any more versatile than that of Gordon Lightfoot. The singer-songwriter from Canada has enjoyed success in the worlds of pop, adult contemporary, and country, with fans of all ages continuing to be enchanted by the singer's unforgettable vocal approach.
The hero would be me. And you won't read that book again, because the ending's just too hard to take. I'd walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script. Enter number two, a movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, love, let's be real.
At the heart of Lightfoot's career is his songwriting, such as the soul of this song, If You Could Read My Mind, written by a man Billboard said knew his relationships could be imperfect at times. Born in 1938, Lightfoot began singing in his youth, studied in California before returning to Canada in the early 1960s, where he has lived ever since, making hits like Beautiful.
Times I just don't know how you could be anything but beautiful. Think that I'm made for you, and you were made for me. And I know that I won't ever change. We've been rain or shine for such a long, long time. Laughing eyes and smiling face, it seems so lucky just to have the right. Telling you with all my might, beautiful tonight. And I know that you will never stray, 'cause you've been that way from day to day for such a long, long time. How could life be anything but beautiful? Think that I was made for you, you were made for me.
Some of Gordon Lightfoot's albums have achieved gold and multi-platinum status internationally. His songs have been recorded by some of the world's most renowned recording artists, including Elvis Presley, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Judy Collins, Barbara Streisand, Sarah McLachlan, and Eric Clapton. At almost 80 years old, Lightfoot's still out on the road, playing to sold-out concerts, and always on his playlist is the super hit Rainy Day People.
Rainy Day People, oh,
always seem to know when it's time to call. Rainy day people don't talk, they just listen till they've heard it all. Rainy day lovers don't lie when they tell you they've been down like you. Rainy day people don't mind if you cry on a tear or two.
You know any rainy day people? Oh yeah, gobs of them, let me tell you. It's amazing, nearly 80 years old and entertaining every weekend. Sold out houses everywhere he goes. Gordon Lightfoot. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Gordon Lightfoot.
Rainy day people all know how it hangs on your peace of mind. Rainy day lovers don't lie when they tell you they've been down there too. Rainy day people don't mind if you cry on a tear or two. Rainy day people always seem to know when you're feeling blue. Step and strutters who land in the gutter sometime need one too. Take it or leave it, or try to believe it if you've been down too long. Rainy day lovers don't hide love inside, they just pass it on.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When President Donald Trump outlined his administration's comprehensive strategy toward Iran, he not only highlighted his concerns with the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, he stressed the necessity of countering Iran's support for terrorism and its destabilizing activity in the Middle East. That support stretches from the regime's earliest days when its agents seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran. It includes Iran's founding and funding of Hezbollah, whose operatives bombed the U.S. embassy in Lebanon twice in the 1980s, and its backing of groups in Iraq and Afghanistan that have killed hundreds of American military personnel. The Iranian dictatorship's aggression continues to this day, President Trump said.
The regime remains the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism and provides assistance to Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Hezbollah, Hamas, and other terrorist networks. It develops, deploys, and proliferates missiles that threaten American troops and our allies. It harasses American ships and threatens freedom of navigation in the Arabian Gulf and in the Red Sea. It imprisons Americans on false charges.
President Trump stressed that Iran's antagonistic behavior is not directed at the United States alone. It violently suppresses its own citizens and others in Iran and has fueled sectarian violence in Iraq and vicious civil wars in Yemen and Syria, where its support props up the Assad regime, a regime that uses chemical weapons against helpless civilians, including children. President Trump said that after consulting U.S. allies, the new strategy will best address the full range of Iran's destructive actions. It includes working with partners to counter the regime's support for terrorist proxies, placing additional sanctions on the regime to block its financing of terror, addressing Iran's proliferation of missiles and the actions that threaten global trade and freedom of navigation, and finally, denying the regime all paths to a nuclear weapon. The execution of this strategy includes the U.S. imposing sanctions on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps for its support for terrorism. President Trump urged U.S. partners to join the United States and take strong actions to curb Iran's continued dangerous behavior. We hope these new measures, directed at the Iranian dictatorship, he said, will compel the government to reevaluate its pursuit of terror at the expense of its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.